May it please the Court?
Certainly.
The issue presented in the first point of the appellant's brief is whether the state presented sufficient evidence of knowing unlawful entry to support Mr. Naylor's conviction for burglary. That issue ultimately boils down to one question. Is a door in a restaurant with a sign that simply says office sufficient to inform a reasonable person that this is somewhere that the general public is not allowed?
How about if we add a fact? And the fact is that the sign on the back door says visitors check in. I forget the exact language. What did it say? Visitors should check in
at the front.
So you not only do you have a door that says office, but isn't it a different factual scenario when anyone coming in the back door is told to go to the front?
There was no evidence presented that Mr. Naylor, the defendant in this case, went in that back door or ever saw that sign that says all visitors report to the front. That fact is absent here.
And so we have two other places he could have come from. One was the side door, is that right? Was there evidence? Or where else could he have come from if not the back door?
I think the front door.
Okay. And so the front door, he would have had to go through the public area of the restaurant and go back into a hallway and into a door marked office?
Presumably.
Couldn't a jury infer from that he should have known that was not open to the public? And restaurants, is that something that the public normally does, goes back into rooms called office?
I do not think it's that unusual of a thing for someone at a restaurant to go in the office of a restaurant. There are a lot of reasons why someone might do that. If you were looking for a job application, if you were going to report a problem to management.
If you left your credit card and were returning to see if they might have your credit card.
Absolutely. Or if you went at a time that the restaurant's not busy and you're not immediately greeted at the door, you would look for an employee of the restaurant, and an office would be a good place to find someone.
And does it matter whether you had such a purpose, whether any such purpose was identified for purposes of the level of crime? Because he didn't say he was trying to apply or that he was looking for a particular employee. He went into the office and allegedly then stole things from the office. And so how do we factor in the fact that you could have a valid reason? Where here did he offer any sort of valid reason?
In a prosecution for burglary, there are two separate elements, the unlawful entry and the unlawful purpose. The unlawful purpose does nothing to prove the unlawful entry. If I could walk into that office and ask for an application, and I'm not guilty of trespass in that scenario, then my client's not guilty of burglary here because there's no unlawful entry. We're not challenging the sufficiency of the stealing conviction.
Does it matter if you're, I guess I'm asking, I'm not sure the briefs address it, so I'm asking, does it matter if the public is invited in for certain purposes and not others, and that a reasonable person would know that you're not invited in the back office to wander around, you are invited in maybe for applying for a job or looking for the manager to complain about something? Or is that not something we look at?
I don't think it is. I think it comes down to, again, the purpose is a separate element than the unlawful entry. If you can lawfully walk in that office, then there's no trespass and thus no
purpose. But is it an all or nothing? If I invite someone to come in and feed my cat while I'm out of town, I don't invite them then to come in when I'm in town. So they can lawfully enter under certain circumstances, but not others.
Right, but in that scenario, when you're in town, they have no permission to enter.
And so what I'm asking, can you say, because they have permission to enter for certain purposes, do they have permission to enter when that's not their purpose?
Again, I would say it's two separate elements. I would say if you have permission to go in this office and ask for an application or ask for a stolen credit card back, then my client cannot, his burglary conviction can't stand because he was somewhere he has a right to be. I don't think one element of burglary cannot prove the other.
To take Judge Stiss' hypothetical, if she gives permission to a cat sitter to come into her house and she is out of town and the cat sitter goes into her, her house not to feed the cat but to steal something mm-hmm. from her jewelry box, is that an unlawful entry?
No, that would be stealing. Just like this was. If you had permission to be in the house, then there's no unlawful entry.
There were surveillance photos. And you're saying that the surveillance photos do not give any indication whether Mr. Naylor went in the front door or the back door?
That is my recollection, yes.
And no evidence from the folks in the front of the restaurant that they didn't see him come in or walk through?
No one testified to ever seeing him at the restaurant.
You may want to turn to your argument about the presence of another.
Yes, please.
Run too far out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. The issue presented there is whether there was sufficient evidence to support his conviction for first-degree burglary, given that there's no one else present in the office when the money was taken from the purse. Essentially what we have, no one would dispute that this restaurant is open to the public. This was during regular business hours. The owner of the restaurant testified. She put her purse down in the office and then was working the floor from open to close, pretty much. So the restaurant is open to the public. In order to make a case for burglary at all, the state has divided the restaurant into the portion open to the public and the portion they claim is not open to the public, the office. By creating that distinction, that they can't create that distinction and then ignore that distinction in order to get first-degree burglary rather than just second-degree burglary.
I know you claim that we should, for purposes of determining whether there's another person in the structure, which I think is what the language of the statute is, you want us to decide that the back of the restaurant is one structure and the front of the restaurant is another structure. You discuss Missouri cases. Is there any case in any state in the country where your theory has been found to not support a burglary conviction?
I do think, to my knowledge, this is largely a case of first impression. I do think the case I cited with the attached garage of the house, the state v.
Is that Washington?
Yes, thank you very much. That is it. I think that is.
But your point is you can't be inconsistent. So if, in fact, it is one structure, and so you consider it occupied because the restaurant's one structure, front and back together, then it has to be considered one structure for the purposes of do you have permission to enter as a member of the public? And you sense that the public clearly could enter the front part of the restaurant. If it's one structure, they could be in the office. You can't inconsistently say it's one structure for purpose of being occupied, but two structures for the purpose of where you have permission to enter and where you don't.
Well,
is that your argument? Or
as argued in my first point, I believe there's no unlawful entry at all. Should this court disagree with me there, the state is the one in this case who's divided the restaurant into two structures in order to get burglary at all.
Well, what's the purpose of burglary in the first degree? Why did the legislature make it a more serious crime if it occurs when there's an individual in the structure?
Yeah, my understanding has always been that there's a potential for some kind of conflict and
danger to the other person, that they might be in a back bedroom and come out into the kitchen and find someone there. So what's the difference between a restaurant that there are persons there that may come back and interrupt the robbery and have a greater risk of a more serious offense?
Well, first of all, that's not what happened here. No one did enter the office.
I'm not asking what happened here. I'm asking, is the purpose served to find it's a first-degree burglary by not dividing it into separate structures, that the legislature would have intended is to punish more severely someone who commits a crime under circumstances that creates a greater risk of harm to a person?
Well, First of all, I'd say there would be a greater risk of harm if this stealing had occurred in the public area of the restaurant where other people were present. So really, in this case, I would say the purpose behind the burglary first distinction actually works in my favor.
But there's a less risk if the building was totally empty.
That's correct. But to say that it should be burglary first because someone could come into the office, that's really no different than saying someone who burglarizes a residence should be charged with first degree burglary because the owner of the residence might come home.
Well, if they happen to be in a room that's part of the same building, isn't that risk greater than that they might come home?
Well, I agree it's not the exact same scenario as a home, but again, there would be a lot more risk of conflict if this had occurred in the public area of the restaurant rather than in this office where, by you know, all the evidence is consistent that no one else was present when the stealing occurred.
Are there cases in Missouri that say if you enter into a private area of a place you otherwise have a right to be, that that's burglary as soon as you open that door? So like if you had a right to be in my home, but my bedroom area said do not enter, are there cases that say that's burglary when you open that bedroom door, or is that just stealing?
That would be burglary, and that's I think there's a big difference between a sign that says do not enter, authorized personnel only, employees only. I think if any of those had been on this door, we'd have a burglary here. But the word office, I don't think, carries the same weight as, you know, do not enter. So in your scenario, yes, I would say that would be a burglary.
I know you're I know you're out of time, but I do want to hear a little bit of argument on point three.
I'll be very brief on that. This court stated in State v. Bernard and reaffirmed in State v. Davis that the, you know, essentially when it comes to the identity exception to presenting evidence of uncharged bad acts, the charged and uncharged crimes must be nearly identical in their methodology and so unusual and distinctive.
That's not us.
Okay. There's nothing unusual or distinctive about the methodology used in the uncharged crimes and the theft from this restaurant. The only similarity is that all three crimes involved stealing or attempting to steal from areas of restaurants where no one else was present. That's a run-of-the-mill stealing from a business. I mean, this is the admission of this evidence is nothing but showing propensity to steal from businesses. And there's nothing unusual or distinctive here. My time's up. There's another question.
But what about the fact that the car was the same and clothing, a lot of identity things were matching? Does that have any bearing?
Well, and, you know, obviously identity was at issue in this trial, but that evidence could have been presented without also presenting the evidence of alleged other crimes. In fact, just real briefly, just a few weeks ago, the Southern District in State v. McVeigh affirmed a somewhat similar issue to this, but in that case, the trial court had indeed limited the evidence to take away the specific evidence of crimes and only let in the identity type evidence. And perhaps something like that would have been appropriate here, but there was no reason to allow the evidence of the uncharged crimes other than to show a propensity. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll hear from your honor.
May it please the court. Knowledge is rarely susceptible to direct proof. In this case,
thank you.
The state was entitled to rely on circumstantial evidence to show that the appellant knew that the office was not open to the public. And appellant's action before and after the crime showed that he was aware that the office was not open to the public. He parked in front of the truck stop, which was not the restaurant. He walked in an alley. He did not even walk into the truck stop. He parked some distance away. He walked in the dark through the alley, and he walked into the restaurant. The surveillance video does not show exactly which door he entered. It shows that he exited the door, the side door, which was always kept locked. It could only be opened from the inside. And for one to get to the side door, one had to walk into the office and then to a storage room that was off the office and unlock a deadbolt that could only be unlocked from inside, and that's where appellant emerged from. He would have entered the restaurant from the back door.
But that would show that he didn't want to be seen, and he maybe showed that he entered with the intent to steal, but does it show that he knows he was in an area that he couldn't be in, inside the building?
Well, it shows that he did not want to appear in a common area, because the restaurant owner also testified that in a cross-examination that she did not know appellant, she did not see him.
But he could have done all those secret things and come in the front of the restaurant and taken money from the till, and that wouldn't have been burglary, that would have been stealing.
Sure, but that's circumstances that the fact finder could consider, in addition to the fact that the door was clearly marked as an office. It was at the end of a hallway. On the side of the door were some lockers with some miscellaneous cleaning items.
Was there evidence, opposing counsel has said, there are legitimate reasons a member of the public might go into an office of a restaurant, apply for a job, or it was mentioned, look for a credit card, or try to find an employee, whether or not he was doing it for that purpose, that it's not totally closed off to the public, there are legitimate reasons the public might go in. Does that make a difference on whether it's burglary?
Well, a legitimate reason would be if somebody opened the door and saw that this was an office and left, maybe, but his action also supports the fact that he would have known, because he went on to walk into the office and walk through another room.
But if it's in fact open to the public, does it matter what his intent was?
I think it shows circumstances that surround his action and what he thought of where he, whether he should be allowed to
was
be.
You're talking about his escape path, but an escape path doesn't necessarily, you know, once you steal, you may want to leave in a way that you're not detected. But how does that show that you knew you weren't supposed to be there in the first place?
It shows that he certainly could have retreated. It shows his knowledge overall, before, during, and after. And also, the state presented evidence that he did enter in two other businesses. He entered into restricted area, so he knew that businesses, there were areas in the businesses where he was not allowed. And
I guess the problem I have is, You are suggesting the word office is synonymous with private. And office designates that there is business that occurs in that space. How does it indicate that it is private?
Well, not just the word office, but where it was located. It was located down the hallway, at an end of a hallway. Exhibits were shown to the jury. There were photographs showing that there are no other doors, such as restrooms, where public would be invited. There were locker rooms, somebody's coats hanging on the side of the office with somebody who would have used the office, and clearly marked as an office.
So if I or any other person has business that you want to conduct with someone at a restaurant that is not related to buying food, you're saying they would be committing a crime and entering unlawfully, trespassing by walking into an area where it says office.
Well, to commit the burglary, they have to have the intent to commit the crime.
Right,
there.
But they commit the crime of trespass if they go into an area that is off limits.
If they entered the area, but if they just wandered and found the the home office and opened it and didn't find anybody in there, they would not be walking in it. They would not be committing any crime in it.
Well, if you went in a closed door marked office, you're saying you should know that's private. So
depending on the circumstances, where it's located, and also appellant's knowledge can be inferred from his action, from the surrounding.
But they're kind of, I think I may, maybe you think there's not two questions, but it seems like there's two questions. One is, was it open to the public? And if it's sometimes open to the public, then opposing counsel's argument is that if it's something the public can enter for some purposes, then it's open to the public, so it's not burglary. His purpose may have been a bad one, to steal, but it's, and so he, and he can get convicted of stealing or attempted stealing if he hadn't gotten anything, but it doesn't make it burglary because it's open to the public for some purposes.
Okay, as far as being open to the public, the owner testified that it was not open to the public. So, and I understand that the appellant is challenging whether he knew his knowledge, that whether a reasonable person would know that this was not open to the
public.
Have
we found any cases around the country that deal with this kind of fact situation?
Not with this specific one.
Something saying office.
But the case law does allow reasonable inferences from the circumstances surrounding the entrance of the office. And here, it's reasonable because this defendant either walked through the back door where there was a notice that everybody should report to the front desk, or he walked through the front door and immediately wandered through the back because nobody saw him there. And in the back, is said so in this case that it shows that it's more of a utility room, sort of, because there were lockers, there were other items of housekeeping for housekeeping purpose, and a reasonable person would know that. And the fact that he unlocked the door that can only be unlocked from outside, from inside, he knew, at that point, he knew he was trespassing. He was walking from one office to another through a locked door that he unlocked. He exited from the back and left. And when he was later arrested, he gave a false story about not taking.
Well, he clearly stole. Yeah.
And
the question is if it's burglary.
Guilt both for stealing and for burglary, for entering premises where portions of the premises where he's not allowed to be. And again, the evidence that he did that on the same actions that he did on the previous day show his motive and intent and knowledge. And that is evidence.
Before you get too far along here, could you address the third point, the use of uncharged prior conduct to prove identity?
Correct. The court specifically admitted that for the purposes of establishing identification. And in this case, the identity wasn't an issue. And the defendant was wearing, we have witnesses from Collinsville who testified that the defendant entered a restricted area of their businesses. He was wearing a white or light colored jacket with dark sleeves, lighter pants, and a baseball cap. These are the same clothes that the man who exited the distinctive orange car, which was also present in Collinsville, he was wearing exactly the same clothes. He parked at the truck stop and walked to the business.
And that goes to show he may be the same person who committed another crime. How does it go to show his identity, that it's him?
Well, it connects him to the car.
And they proved the car.
It's the same person. And somebody who saw him in Collinsville in person, because nobody saw him at the restaurant in this case. So witnesses who saw him in Collinsville, they testified he wore the same clothing, and they identified him as the same man who was at trial, who was driving the same distinctive orange car that was present in Collinsville. In Collinsville, one of the witnesses also saw a partial license plate, which matched the car the defendant was driving. And the same car was seen at the crime scene in a present case. Also in Collinsville, one of the witnesses spoke to appellant, and he identified his very distinctive, raspy voice. Appellant had a distinctive voice when he spoke to the police after he was arrested.
Opposing counsel argues, I believe, that the standard is the one that was discussed, the modus operandi, or signature, or fingerprint, has to be that distinctive. Do you agree that's the test that should be applied here?
The case law allows the identity, when identity is an issue, that evidence of other crime can come in for a specific reason. Identity has to be an issue. Identity is an issue here. And it is very distinctive, even if that was the standard, because we have somebody who was using the same car, wearing the same clothes, within a short period of time, had distinctive voice. Additionally, here, this evidence falls within an exception of his knowledge and in intent, because he puts his knowledge in issue. In fact, were one of the points that he raised.
How do you respond to the argument that that the evidence could have been limited to serve the purpose of identity without bringing in the fact of other criminal acts?
Well, first, the appellant did not ask the court to redact the evidence below, so it's I'm not sure what other ways the prosecutor could have presented the evidence had this been brought to the prosecutor's attention, or had the court asked for the prosecutor to redact it. The evidence from Collinsville was that he walked into one business, and he walked into the back, into the kitchen area, and spoke to somebody. There is no evidence he stole anything there. He just walked into the restricted area, encountered an employee. He spoke to the employee. Employee was able to identify his raspy voice. Another employee saw him leave in the orange car and saw the partial license plate. The other business is where somebody discovered that money was missing from an office, and an employee testified that she watched the video, the surveillance video, and she observed a distinctive orange car parked by the office. And then a police investigated. The video itself was not shown to the jury. It was the police officer who investigated, who took still photographs of that video, presented the photographs, which were the photographs of the men who entered that office. And to the extent that there might be some danger for prejudice, the court in this case specifically instructed the jury not to consider this evidence as propensity evidence. Instruction number 11 told the jury that they could only consider this evidence as evidence of identity, motive, intent, absence of mistake or common scheme and plan. So the jury, the court's instruction cured any danger for prejudice.
What's the limitations? When can evidence of common scheme or plan be admissible? What are the limitations on that?
I'm not sure that either the prosecutor or the state here has taken the position that it's a common scheme.
It doesn't matter if that was argued to the court. If that would be a legal basis, that we would affirm the trial court if there was a legal basis for the admission of the evidence. Here, three potential circumstances occurred of an individual attempting to steal from a business within 16 hours by someone wearing the same clothing. So I'm asking, could it fit within the evidence of common scheme or plan?
Potentially, arguably, maybe. But that wasn't something that was argued to the jury either. But it could arguably fall within that instruction. Maybe we need to have a little bit more evidence, more detail on the planning or the actual execution. They happened within a very short period of time, and certainly...
I'm not asking on the facts of this case. Do you know what the legal parameters are for a common scheme and plan? That's fine if you don't. I just
was... Not on top of my
head. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Just briefly on the issue of whether or not there was unlawful entry, point one of my brief, the state brings up a lot of evidence about where Mr. Naylor parked, how he walked toward the building, the fact that he went out a side door. Again, we're not contesting the sufficiency of the evidence to support the stealing conviction. It's suspicious.
Well, but there's a distinction here. It has to be an unlawful entry, and he has to know it's an unlawful entry. So doesn't that evidence... Well, let me ask you, are you arguing that it wasn't an unlawful entry, regardless of what he knew or thought? That, or are you arguing that it was an unlawful entry, but he didn't know it was unlawful?
The owner of the restaurant did testify that no one was allowed in the restaurant. I'm sorry, no one was allowed in the office of the restaurant.
So he was trespassing.
Well,
he may or may not have known whether he was trespassing, but he was trespassing. You would agree with that?
Well, I think trespassing has a knowingly requirement, too, and I don't think that's satisfied here.
Okay. But he was where he had no license to be.
Yes. But there's... He was...
So why doesn't her evidence of the circumstances inform us as to not whether it was unlawful, but whether he believed and knew it was unlawful?
Clearly he knew that taking money out of a purse that wasn't his was unlawful. So any suspicious behavior, either before or after that stealing, is explained by the fact that he's committing stealing. He's knowingly committing a crime, stealing. What there's not evidence of is any unlawful entry, knowing unlawful entry, and therefore no burglary. We're not contesting that there's the unlawful purpose element of burglary is met here. It's the unlawful entry. And one element does not prove the other. I don't see what the path he took to get to this office. There's talk about going through a group area with lockers and coats. Excuse me. Again, this case comes down to whether or not the reasonable person is supposed to know that you can't walk into the office of a restaurant. And I would say you absolutely can, and it's a reasonable thing to do for many reasons, as I discussed earlier. So the path he took to get there, you know, if I leave my credit card at a restaurant and I go back the next day to get it and I want to go to the office, I don't see why it would matter what path I took to get to the office.
Well, suppose Judge Stith wants me to sit her cat and...
Would you?
Every day. And a year and a half later, I'm charged with burglarizing her house, and I plan to defend on the basis that she authorized my entry. Wouldn't the fact that I was caught shinnying up a drain pipe and going in through a window at least inform the fact finder's view on whether or not I thought I had permission?
I don't believe the method of entry. I mean, that's not the scenario here, but I don't believe the method of entry particularly matters. The general public would not know they don't have the right to be in the office area of a restaurant.
You're saying it would support an inference he was entering for the purpose of a crime, but not an inference that he knew he was in an area which the public couldn't be in.
Exactly. Thank you very much. My time's up. Unless there's any other questions.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.